If you listen to Hometown Heroes on KMJ, you've heard hundreds of World War II veterans share their unique experiences, but I'm pretty sure the crux of this soon-to-be 92-year-old story is something we haven't heard before. Getting his jaw broken in a barroom brawl actually saved his life. You want to hear that one explained, don't you? I'm Paul Leffler, inviting you to join us at Carrington Point at 1 o'clock on News Talk 580, or catch Hometown Heroes at 5 p.m. on FM 105.9 KMJ.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday here on News Talk 580 KMJ, or maybe you catch us on the FM side at 105.9 at 5 o'clock. You can also hear the program online anytime at kmjnow.com. Each week we visit with World War II veterans. The idea is to, first of all, let them know how much we appreciate their service, the sacrifices they made for our freedom. We want to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten. And along the way, I think the rest of us learn a thing or two about what life was like all those years ago and what it means to really love your country. We're going to hear a little bit about that today from a longtime Navy man, Marcus Weisgerber. He lives here at Carrington Point in Fresno. You've been hearing about Carrington Point the last couple weeks. And let's go back a few years, though, Marcus. You're originally from Rocky Top, Tennessee. Peakland in the Knoxville area, that's where you grew up?
Yes, sir.
What happened to that Tennessee accent? They beat it out of you early?
I don't know. Some of the people say I still got it.
Even after living all those years in New York and all your time in the Navy. The one question I like to ask every veteran that I talk to, I like to ask about December 7th, 1941. Where were you and what do you remember about how you learned of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor?
I was making a delivery with for a transfer company in Knoxville, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. I heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Did that rock your world a little bit?
Yes, it did. I just wondered what was going to happen after that. Got my notice from Uncle Sam to come and help out, I guess you'd say. And I joined the Navy. And
about a month later, I think, right?
A month later, January the 7th.
At this point, you're 21 years old. I'm sure you had your own ideas of what life was going to be like. And now this came along. Was that hard to get used to the idea of things were changing in your world?
Yeah, well, we went to, when I was drafted, I went to the post office, and they give you a choice of going in the Army or the Navy. And I chose the Navy, and not knowing what it was about, how long I'd be there, I went in for 6 years in the regular Navy, not in the reserves. Stayed in for 6 years, went through both European and Pacific theater, and survived.
Yeah, and you're here telling me about it, but it's not a fluke that you've survived. There's some pretty interesting twists along the way that we're going to hear about. And you were involved in some pretty early action. In fact, less than a year after you joined, you were part of an invasion in North Africa. Tell me about that. What kind of ship were you on, and what was that situation like?
I was on the USS Palmer, DMS-5, and we were a high-speed minesweeper. And we were at a place called Vadella, a little bit north of Casablanca, Africa. And we went in and swept for mines, I would say a couple of thousand feet off the shore, high speed, 25 knots. And we made a couple of runs. It was shells far and all around us, but we never got hit.
What were your duties on the ship?
I was down in the fire room. I was farming at the time, farming first class. Manning the boilers, make sure we kept steam up.
Did you prefer being below deck, or was it hard not to know what was going on up above deck?
Well, I preferred being below deck because I had been associated with steam before I ever went in the Navy, and that was my goal, to work in the fire room.
What had you done with steam before the war?
My daddy had sawmills and steam engines, and got acquainted with it that way.
So this was right up your alley?
Yeah, I made a career of it, made chief in the Navy from it, and got a civilian job after I retired from the Navy and with Grumman Aircraft. I was lead man in the boiler room in Grumman Aircraft in Bethpage, Long Island, New York.
There was a lot you'd have to go through first. And so this minesweeper, the USS Palmer, DMS stands for Destroyer Minesweeper. So this is not a big ship, but you are kind of on the outskirts. You're kind of expendable. They want you to sweep for mines because if you hit something, it's not going to blow up a big ship. Did that ever bother you at all?
Well, we was clearing the way for the landing parties, too. And that was a big armada of ships at that time, I think 800. And that armada that went, they got together from areas on the East Coast and went to North Africa at the time.
Did you ever wake up in the morning and say, I don't know what's going to happen today. I don't know if I'm going to be awake tomorrow. I'm in a little bit of danger here.
Oh, it crossed my mind a few times, yes. You get used to it. You just take days as they come and never worry about it too much.
Well, I guess I got ahead of myself a little bit because I believe it was probably just before you shipped out for that invasion of North Africa that you were at Coney Island having some fun and you met somebody special?
Yeah, I met my wife in Coney Island.
Well, there's got to be more to the story than that. What were you doing at Coney Island?
Well, I was having fun. I was having a few beers and on the boardwalk. And we went out at a tavern under the boardwalk, me and a guy named Charlie Taylor. He was from Tennessee. And we met these two girls walking down boardwalk. And naturally, we said, is it all right to walk with you? And my wife turned to the other girl and said, which one do you want? And she said, I'll go with Taylor. And my wife said, well, I'll go with Marcus.
As simple as that, huh?
Yeah. And we walked them home that night. And we stayed in touch and writing letters and stayed in communication with each other during World War II.
Well, at what point did you say, hey, I'm going to marry this girl?
After the war was over, after the peace in Japan.
Had you asked her to wait around for you, though?
Well, we just never talked much about marriage. We just figured one day to get married, that's it.
Well, that's pretty incredible, given the way things are today. That's a really neat story. And you would have to go through quite a bit to make it back to marry her. This invasion of North Africa, anything that stands out about that? Any close calls or any point where you said, wow, this was something pretty special that we were just involved in?
No, not really. We didn't have no close calls after. We went in and done our mine sweeping. We went back out on patrol at the with a fleet that was in there. About a week it was over there, and we went down to Casablanca and had liberty. Come back to Norfolk, Virginia. Got back into Virginia around Christmas time, I think it was, and made preparations to come to the Pacific.
And the Palmer would have a certain fate, but you would have a different fate. Now, I've met a lot of people that say a lot of things saved their lives. But I don't know if I've talked to someone yet who said getting in a fist fight in a bar in San Francisco and getting your jaw broken actually saved your life. Is that really true, that saved your life?
I think so. I had to go to a hospital in Oak Knoll in Oakland, California, and my ship left without me.
Well, I want to hear about this fight, first of all, because this is a big part of the story. What, you're up to no good in a bar in San Francisco? What happened?
No, I put in a quarter to play some country music.
Being a Tennessee boy, you had to hear some country, huh?
Yep. And some guy went over and cut it off, and I didn't like it. So I hit him, and next thing you know, he hit me. And we had a brawl in there, about six guys, and I ended up in Oak Knoll Hospital. And by the way, he went with me, too.
And I imagine you were probably feeling sorry for yourself or weren't too happy about things at that point.
Yeah, I hated to miss the ship, but I did, and it turned out it was the best thing ever happened to me.
And this would be a while until what happened to the Palmer happened, and I guess for a while you probably thought you were going to catch up to them eventually?
I was en route to pick up the ship. When I left the hospital and went to the Johnson Islands and went aboard a ship that was acting as a receiving ship for guys like me and other ones. That things happened and they was waiting for their ship. But my ship never did come, and I was made ship's company of the ship I was on, the USS Signal. And never did get back to my old ship. It's a good thing I didn't, because the ship was sunk at Ligayen Gulf. And I would have been killed because my battle station was, nobody survived where my battle station would have been.
Do you remember when you found out about that and what it did to you to hear that news?
No, I don't remember when I found out about it. But when I did find out about it, I just wondered how many of my friends, shipmates, got killed. And I didn't actually know that till after the war, they had a ship's reunion of the USS Palmer. And I went to I made it an effort to go to the reunion. And there was about 12 guys at the reunion that survived the sinking. And they told me who got killed and who didn't. I think it was only a couple of my friends, real guys that I hung out with. They survived. I still say that little altercation we had in the bar in San Francisco saved my life during World War II.
Yeah, and what did that make you think of when you realized that? When you got to that point, you heard about what happened to the Palmer, you realized that had you been there at your battle station, that you would have been killed, that all these other guys died, and that for some reason you survived. How did you process that? What did that mean to you?
Well, I don't know. I had different feelings about it. I just wondered I could have survived. I don't know where anybody could survive what happened on the ship. But, I was in the Navy, and I was prepared to do what I was asked of, and I was there for a reason. I never thought much of it after that, but I always thought of my friends that got killed.
Did that serve as extra motivation for you? Because you stayed in the Navy for a long time. You had the chance to marry and have a family. Do you think that knowing what it could have been like, kept you from taking things for granted?
Yeah, I think so. After World War II, there was not much work. It was hard to get a job, and me and my wife talked it over, and I told her I was going to re-up in the Navy, and she says, okay. So I re-upped for 2 years. At that time, you could re-enlist for 2 years at a time. I'd re-upped till I was in 10 years, and my wife said, you might as well stay in for the other 10. So that's what I did, and raised a family in between.
Yeah, he went through quite a bit. And I know we're going to bounce around a little bit here time-wise, and that's a really intriguing story about the Palmer, and I'm sure that resonates with people, knowing how close you came and how it could have been you. Tell me about this ship, the Signal, because you were on that for a while before you caught another ship. Were your duties pretty mundane? Are there any events that really stand out for you?
Not on there, no. It was a stationary ship. It just went from, Kwajalein to Eniwetok, back and forth on the Ulithi. And we changed stations every once in a while. And it was stationary just for other ships to fuel from.
Gotcha. Well, it's time to catch a commercial break, but when we come back, we'll explore some other aspects of Marcus Weisgerber's story. His life was spared. You heard him say how that barroom brawl saved his life, but things were much different for his younger brother, Clay, who was in the Army. We'll learn about that when Hometown Heroes continues after some words from our sponsors, like Fresno Distributing.
It's as simple as ABC, Fresno T.
I can remember hearing that jingle on the radio for years, but I didn't really understand what it meant until redoing my shower a couple years ago. This is Paul Leffler, proud to welcome Fresno Distributing as a sponsor of Hometown Heroes here on KMJ. The knucklehead who tiled my shower, that would be yours truly, left a decent-sized hole around the shower arm. I needed an oversized flange to cover it, and I went all over town. None of the chain stores had what I needed. Finally, a merciful soul asked me, Have you tried Fresno D? Fresno D, as in duh, why didn't I think of that in the first place? So I quickly took the 41 of the McKinley exit, walked into Fresno Distributing, and bumped smack dab into the owner, Steve Cloud. He said he was sure they had exactly what I needed, and of course, he was right. Now I make Fresno D my first stop, whether I'm looking for one of those obscure plumbing parts or a top-of-the-line appliance, like the new Electrolux energy-efficient washer and dryer set my wife picked out. They have all the other top brands, too. Don't make the mistake I did. If you want your first stop to be your last stop, make a beeline for Fresno D. And while you're there, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes on KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis, its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with 91-year-old Marcus Weisgerber here at Carrington Point. He'll be 92 next month, and he told us how a fight over what kind of music was on the jukebox in a San Francisco nightclub actually saved his life. The broken jaw he suffered caused him to miss his assignment on the USS Palmer, which was later sunk by the Japanese. Had Marcus been at his duty station, he's pretty sure he would have been killed. Now, I want to ask you about something else. You were the oldest in your family, but you had a younger brother who was in the Army. How often did you hear what was going on with him while the war was going on?
I never heard anything about him.
But you knew he was in the service.
Yeah, he went into service in 1941.
So he was in before you?
Oh, yes. He was at Fort Knox, Kentucky, and he was sent to D-Day. And I talked to somebody, a guy that was with him after that, was with him when he got killed. He'd been on the beach about 7-8 days. When he got killed. Felt bad about that.
So he was killed in June of 44 at Normandy.
Omaha Beach.
When you were able to talk to someone who was there, what did that do for you and your own ability to process that?
Well, it made you feel that somebody survived to tell you more or less what happened to him. Some way this guy survived the whole war and came back after the whole war was over, you know. It made you feel like it, I guess I was lucky, but I lost my brother. He was next to me. He was 2 years younger than I was.
And did you find out before you got home from World War II, or when did you find out that your brother had been killed in the D-Day invasion?
I heard from my sister in Tennessee. She was my brother's beneficiary. I got the call from her that Clay got killed. And like I said, they brought him back about 10, 12 years later, 58, I think it was. They brought his remains back, and he was buried in the National Cemetery in Knoxville, Tennessee.
You know, this program is called Hometown Heroes, and a lot of veterans bristle at that because they don't want to be called heroes. And the refrain I hear from all the veterans over the years is that the real heroes were the ones who didn't come home, more than 400,000 Americans who were killed in World War II. And that includes your brother. What kind of impact has that had on you, knowing that your brother paid the ultimate price and you didn't have to? Did you feel like you had to live up to his sacrifice?
Well, I stayed in the Navy, and I was prepared to go to any other conflict that arose during those times. But when you in the service like that, you never think about dying or nothing like that. But it makes you feel that maybe if you'd have done more, that he would have been alive. But I don't know how I could have helped him. We were in two different branches of service, but you think about it.
Well, and you were obviously impacted personally by that ultimate sacrifice in World War II. And you also ended up with a duty that brought you face to face with the real price of freedom and the cost of war. After the signal, they put you on a ship. In fact, they had you, part of the crew, to commission a ship called the USS Sanctuary. Tell me about that ship and what its purpose was.
Well, it was, I went to school before that, and I was finished in the first 10 graduates from school, and you had your pick of ships. They had a blackboard there with the list of ships that was available, different types. And I was sitting next to this guy. We were both the same rate. I was second class, petty officer. And he says, I think I'll pick that hospital ship. I said, you don't want to go on a hospital ship. Let's get on a destroyer or a cruiser or something. He said, okay, I'm going to take that cruiser available, and he picked a cruiser. So they came to me, and he says, Weisgerber, what do you want? I said, I'll take the hospital ship because they don't shoot at them. And the guy turned around and hit me upside the head, said, you went and took the ship I was going to take. But anyway, I was assigned to it was going in commission in Hoboken, New Jersey. And I was shipped up there to it and put it in commission in New Jersey. And we were sent to the Pacific. It was Sanctuary AH-5. We went through the Panama Canal, and we were on our way between Panama and Pearl Harbor when the war in Japan was over. And the hospital ship always had its lights on. It never did. It was identifiable at all times. And this was about 11 o'clock at night we found out about it. And naturally, everybody was cheering, and we was glad the war was over.
What did it mean to you personally that this war was over? This war that you'd been in on since about a month into America's involvement into it and everything that you've been through, to hear that news that this war is over, what did that mean to you?
It means it didn't have to take no more chances. Maybe we'd survive the whole rest of your life, you know.
Were there days where you weren't sure about that, where you thought this might be it?
No, not really, no.
So you had the celebration for VJ Day, and then the Sanctuary had a very historic distinction. You guys were the first ship to be loaded with American prisoners of war to evacuate them from...
Well, it wasn't the first ship, I don't think, but we went into Nagasaki, and we went in to take medical supplies in there to the people. There were people that survived the bomb. And after that, we were assigned to what they called a magic carpet run between San Francisco and, I guess you would say, Okinawa, Japan. And we went to a place called Wakayama, Japan, and picked up prisoners of war. And we went to a couple more places I can't think of right now and picked up American prisoners of war. Brought them back to the States, and I guess we made about three round trips from San Francisco to Japan to do this magic carpet run.
And you guys really were a magic carpet for them because they had been through so much, and a lot of them had died in captivity. A lot of people thought they would die in captivity, so you really were great rescuers for them. But what did you see? How hard was it to see people in this condition the way those POWs were?
You can't describe how some of the prisoners looked like. They were more or less just skin and bones. And you didn't, But they were all happy, seemed they laughing, and, you know, glad to be rescued. And it was really sad to see people like how they could survive and look like they did. But they did, and made you think it could have been me. Or
yeah, I can imagine thinking it could have been you, and you describe it as sad. And I wonder, too, if at the same time it was inspiring to see people who had been through that much and still have the resolve that so many of them had. I don't want to sugarcoat it, but were you impressed or inspired by some of the people that you encountered?
Well, I was inspired by, I guess, by seeing that they were still alive, but their condition didn't impress me that much, because I don't know, it was so sad, but it was so, I don't know the word to use, exhilarating to see that they went through what they did and still was going to go home.
And you guys were their ticket home. Did you have many conversations with any of those POWs?
No, I didn't have no conversations at all with them. But they was all taken, got medical care, what they needed aboard the hospital ship. We had a good doctor's crew on there, and had 32 nurses, and it was well taken care of.
And you were working in the boiler room this whole time?
Yes, always down in the fire room.
And it was always important to keep that ship moving, but you probably felt just as big a responsibility now, knowing that here are these guys who have been suffering in captivity with nothing to eat, being tortured, and you don't want them stalled at sea somewhere, huh?
No, no.
And I don't want to dwell on it too much, but is it safe to say that it was really hard to feel sorry for yourself with all those people aboard ship that had so much to feel sorry about?
Well, I don't know how to answer that. I was glad it wasn't me. I felt sorry for them, what they went through with. And I often thought that under some circumstances, it could have been me. That's wartime, and anything could happen, you know.
Well, and I know for someone who spent nearly 20 years in the Navy as you did, I know that you always have a job to do, and that's your job, to do your job. You follow orders. But I'm wondering if having a duty like that, to go from being an instrument of war, so to speak, to somebody's rescuer and bringing some people home, people who thought they may never make it home, did that give you some satisfaction to know that you were a part of something so positive that was making such a difference for so many?
Oh, certainly. Yes, it did. I was glad to be a part of it.
But it wasn't an easy journey on the sanctuary either. Not that anybody was shooting at you, but Mother Nature threw you guys for a couple rides. How many typhoons did you go through on that ship?
Just one. It was pretty rough, but we survived it. Ship rolled around a little bit, but being in the Navy, you didn't worry about the storms. Ships were made to where they could survive the storms.
Did you ever go topside during the typhoon?
Oh, yeah.
What did it look like?
Well, you had waves about 25 feet high, I guess, or 20 feet. Ship was rolling all over, up and down, rolling to the sides. Being in the storms before that, you got used to it, and you never thought of it.
What was that like below deck? Did you guys have to tie yourselves down in the boiler room or anything?
No, you grab a hold of something and hold on. You still had your work to do down there.
Yeah, sounds like you got used to it pretty well. So you're on a ship that ends up sinking, but you got off because of the fight you got in. Then you're on this hospital ship bringing POWs back. And then you're finally home from World War II, and there's this young lady that you met at Coney Island that you've been keeping in touch with. When did you see her again, and how long did you guys wait to tie the knot?
We got married in 1946 and lived happily ever after, I guess you would say.
Had you ever wondered if she would still be around when you got back from the war?
Not really. We kept in touch. We had communications, writing letters to each other.
Have you ever thought, because you went on to have 4 children and 6 grandchildren and 6 great-grandchildren, so I see at least 16 people there that would have never been born if you didn't make it home from that war, or if you hadn't been a knucklehead and gotten your jaw broken in a bar in San Francisco. You ever think about that? And if so, what does that tell you? How do you process that?
No, I never think about it. I just think sometimes that the family that I have, if it hadn't been for World War II, I would have probably never had this family. In fact, I would have never saw New York, I doubt, if it hadn't been for World War II. It changed my whole way of living, of life. And we got married, and I stayed in New York till I came out here 2006 to California. We had our own home, and after we retired, we traveled and enjoyed few of the years that we had left. Unfortunately, I lost my wife 17 years ago.
And I'm sure you run into a lot of people around here at Carrington Point that lived through World War II, so they know what was going on back then. But when you talk to somebody who wasn't alive then, and you try to explain what happened, what it was all about, why people like you, people like your brother, did what you did, how do you explain that? If for someone who doesn't get it, who doesn't know why we should think about World War II today, why it matters to us, what's your answer to that?
It's a different world out there today, but I've had more compliments since I've came to California from the people that live here. I wear my hat all the time that I'm retired from the Navy, and different hats I've got, and they always say to me, thanks for serving. The people that ask me this would say that they are glad it was people like me and millions of others that served to keep our country free, and appreciate that.
So you saying they didn't do that in New York?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. They.
I thought you were telling us the Central Valley people are just a little kinder than they are in Long Island.
Well, I've had more comments out here, I'll put it that way.
Good. That means we're doing our job out here. We need to step away for another moment or two, but when we come back, more with Navy veteran Marcus Weisgerber. He'll be 92 in a few weeks, but he's still sharing that infectious smile out here at Carrington Point in Fresno. The rest of Hometown Heroes, right after some more thoughts on our sponsors, starting with Fresno Distributing. What do you think of when I say Fresno D? Probably that catchy little jingle, right?
It's as simple as ABC, Fresno D.
Paul Leffler here to tell you what it means to me. It means Fresno Distributing's selection of top-of-the-line appliances at wholesale prices for you, me, and everybody means you don't have to go anywhere else. Since I started hosting Bulldog Coaches shows in Fresno D's showroom a few years back, I've gotten to know the owner, Steve Cloud, quite well. I know that some of his favorites are King Tut, Coca-Cola with real sugar in it, and of course the Bulldogs. I know not to challenge him in gin rummy because he's a former world champion, no joke. But the other thing I know, and here's why my wife and I picked out our new Electrolux washer and dryer there, I know the Cloud family has been carrying the best appliances you can find anywhere since 1946. Bosch, Frigidaire, Maytag, Jennair, KitchenAid, Wolf, you name it. They have it. Don't just take my word for it. Go see for yourself at Fresno Distributing on McKinley between Blackstone and 41. Plumbing, lighting, electrical, kitchen, bath, whatever you need, Fresno D has it. And you won't find friendlier or more knowledgeable service anywhere. A locally owned business with great prices, great selection, and great service. Why go anywhere else? Still as simple as ABC, Fresno D.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Los Banos at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Los Banos every once in a while, so next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Los Banos.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with Marcus Weisgerber at Carrington Point. He spent nearly 20 years in the Navy, including almost all of World War II. Next week on Memorial Day, he'll be thinking of his younger brother, Clay, who was in the Army and died in the invasion of Normandy. Back to your story now, Marcus. Can you explain why you did what you did or why you felt it was important to do? I know the government didn't really give you a choice, but you stayed in for 20 years. That was certainly your choice. Why was that important to you? What about serving our country in the Navy was something that you thought was worthwhile?
Well, after 6 years, you get used to it. You have no other, you don't have nothing, you just know Navy life. You was always glad to get long weekends, that way you could go home and see your wife and your kids. And you always look forward to having 30 days leave a year you had. A lot of times I got anxious to go back if you'd been home for 3 years or 3 months, 3 weeks. You was always glad to get back to the ship in some cases, you know.
When you look back on it now, do you see things that being in the Navy taught you that maybe you wouldn't have gotten if you weren't in the Navy?
Yes. I got a good education in the Navy from the maintenance and operation and taking care of boilers and everything, and that helped me when I got out to get a job. Most any, if you had a like an engineering rate, you could always end up getting a job at. You had that experience from the Navy.
You know, we kind of glossed over it, but you mentioned when you were on the sanctuary visiting a city where this revolutionary weapon had been used. Did you get any taste of what the atomic bomb had done to that city? Did you see much of that aftermath?
I never went ashore there, but you could see from the ship the devastation that it did. It was unbelievable. It was one or two buildings, skeleton of one or two buildings still standing, and everything else was just melted to the ground. It was unbelievable to see what that bomb of destruction caused. And they did it to another city, and I guess eventually would have done it to the another one if it, war wasn't... peace wasn't signed.
Well, yeah, and it strikes me that you stayed in the Navy till 1961. So you were in the Navy during some of the tense times in the Cold War when there was this constant threat between the U.S. and the Soviets that a nuclear weapon could be deployed. Was that, did that ever run across your mind when you're out there?
No, we didn't think about it. I was never involved in all that Cold War stuff, but we always made these... Goodwill tours, they called them, to the Mediterranean, Italy, and France. And after World War II, you used to go over there for 4 or 5 months at a time. What they call goodwill tours.
What did they do with you while the Korean War was going on?
We just went about our duties here on the East Coast. We didn't. We never entered into the Korean War.
I bet your wife was thankful for that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, another thing on your wall, and there's a picture of you and your wife when you had first met. Good-looking guy with that Navy hat on. And you also have a big certificate that says that you are one of the proud, the few, the people to penetrate the Arctic Circle. You took a ship all the way up toward the North Pole?
Yeah, the USS New Jersey, battleship 62, BB-62.
This is in the late 50s?
Yeah, about 57, 58, I forget which. We went up there on a mission to fuel at sea from a tanker that the oil was not heated to be transferred, and how long it would take to pump oil in its original state from the tanker to the New Jersey.
So you guys were guinea pigs.
Well, it was just one of the missions that they was always experimenting with something, you know, and how long it would take. And then when you heat it all, it gets thin and pump a lot faster, you know. I guess we were up there. We was about 100 miles from Greenland, I think, above the Arctic Circle. It's really cold there.
I was going to say, you probably want to go topside and look around, but you don't want to go topside because you'll freeze your nose off.
Well, we were up. I went up and walked around. I was at the fueling station topside, and it was pretty foggy at the time, too. Visibility was very small. They got through with their exercise, and we came back home.
When you look back on all of that, you're going to be 92 next month. What are you most thankful for?
You know, I really don't know. I don't think I'd ever last this long. I'm thankful that I'm alive, but sometimes you wonder what you're doing here. You get, at our age, you have all these aches and pains, but I've saw a fulfillment of my life, so I just take it day by day, Paul, and that's it.
What do you think keeps you going?
That's hard to answer. I think what keeps us going is the progress we've made in medication today and the care that we get. I think that's what's keeping us all. You figure all the people we got here in Carrington Point, they're either in their 80s or high 90s. Some of them are 100. Some of them are better shape than I am, and they're 10 years older.
You ever trade World War II stories with some of the other residents?
A couple of the guys I got used to here. And one of them passed away here about a couple of months ago, April the 1st. And we used to talk about World War II. He was in the Air Force, and we used to talk about how he survived, and thankful that we're here to talk about it.
And that's not going to be the case forever. One of the reasons I started doing this several years ago is I saw a statistic about how many World War II veterans died every day, and I don't want to be morbid, but when you think about the fact that someday you guys are all going to be gone, those of you who were in the service during World War II, when that happens, what do you want the rest of us Americans to know about that? What should we remember about that time? What's important to know?
Just think of us, that we fought to keep the freedom that we have. You know what kind of shape the world's in today. Nobody likes us, so to speak. And we have to be alert at all times and try to keep these here people that don't like us out of our country and keep doing the good work that you're doing today, thinking of us and preserve what we got.
Is there something you would say you're most proud of that you contributed to in your time in the Navy?
Most thing I was proud of was when it was over, when the war was over. I don't think I would go through it again, but I don't regret one day that I spent in the Navy. But I don't know whether I could do it again or not. It's a changed world today, and it's not like it was back when I went in. It was not as complicated as it is today, you know. Everything's done by computers today, and people sit and push buttons. And back then, we had to use our hands and our brain, I guess you'd say.
And the thing that so many veterans have told me that they see as a difference, and there are a lot of reasons for it, I suppose, but everybody tells me that you felt like everybody was in it together, that, you know, Americans were all pulling on the same end of the rope and weren't running in 10 different directions. Did you feel that unity?
Yes. Yes, I did. It was a team effort. And I mean, we didn't have nobody that I knew of talked against us or anything like that. But it was all one big team.
Was there anything else that I haven't asked you about that you think we ought to know?
No, I don't know. I don't know. I might get in trouble over this. I never expected to have an interview like this. I appreciate it, and I tried to answer everything as accurate as I could, but it's one thing I've still got is a good memory. I don't know where this is legitimate or not, but my daughter owned a store here in Fresno, Postal Annex, and she told me to mention her store on this interview. It's on Bullard and First Street, so anybody wants to go down there, mail home a package to somebody.
And maybe they can get some more stories about you that you haven't told us.
I've told you about everything that I important to talk about.
Well, on behalf of all our listeners, I want to say thank you for serving our country and thank you for telling us about it. In closing, the other thought I have, and I don't want to make you emotional or anything, but have you ever taken time? I asked you about your own life and the fact that if you aren't in that fight, you're not here talking to me. Have you ever wondered about your brother and what his life would have been like if he hadn't died at Omaha Beach in one of the most historic and victorious days in invasions in American history, that he was part of that price paid? Have you ever thought about that?
Yes. I'm sorry I never got to talk to him about his life in the Army and how he survived. And the way it turned out, I was a survivor. I had two other brothers that didn't go into service on account of disabilities, and he and I were the only two of our family, the immediate family, that went into service. Yes, I wondered how it would have been like to get together over a few beers and talk about our experiences and I in the Navy and he in the Army. Because the reason I chose the Navy, I knew I'd have a clean bed to sleep in at night. I wouldn't have to sleep in a foxhole someplace. But I enjoyed my years in the Navy. I still have a few friends that I still keep in touch with. And naturally, they're about my age or maybe a little younger, a little older. I got, I don't know where this is important now, but there was a, my son put my name on the internet here, and anybody that knew me to get in touch. And he heard from some guy here in California, it was down south someplace. He saw my ship sunk, and he said it went down about 2 minutes and 20 seconds or something like that. Nobody's still living that, as I know of, that's on the, was on the Palmer when I was on it.
Was that meaningful for you to hear that story about the Palmer?
It sure was, and it just made me think that 2 minutes and something, you can't do much to save your life. He said it went down, bomb hit after engineering quarters and sunk stern first.
So that just cemented for you in your mind that there's no way you would have survived.
Oh, no, I could have never survived. I think everybody was more or less killed on impact when the bomb hit. The kamikaze went and dropped the bomb, and it crashed right alongside. It was shot down. It crashed right alongside the ship, but the bomb hit right in the engineering spacers.
So that would have been you, but it wasn't. So, again, I don't want to put any words in your mouth, but you feel like somebody was looking out for you or had other plans for you?
There was somebody looking out for me. Maybe my wife was, she was then my girlfriend. Maybe she was saying a few good words about me. I don't know. There's always somebody looking out for you. I guess you saw that in life, too.
Oh, you can say that again. We are out of time. Thanks to Marcus Weisgerber. And go to KMJNow.com to see what he looks like now, even what he looked like then. And please join us again next week for another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.